Hi, I'm Daniel Enzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studio. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Today's episode is an interview with Dave Rock, a performer who is the guitarist for the band Oregon Fairchild and a teaching artist based in Western New York. Yes, you heard me right, Oregon Fairchild. Dave has maintained a career in the arts for 30 years. For those listeners who are in the arts, and maybe those of you that aren't, you can understand what an accomplishment this is. Dave has done this by diversifying his offerings. In addition to playing with Oregon Fairchild, he also works as a teaching artist and creates and performs programming at schools that directly relate to their curriculum. We speak about what it means to be a teaching artist and how that can inform or inspire an artist's work. Dave also mentions the genesis of the workshops and trainings that are available on his website. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dave as much as I did.
Thank you, Dave, so much for speaking with us today. It is great to connect with you.
Well, I'm glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could give us maybe a brief biographical sketch of sort of where you grew up and maybe how you found music.
Sure. Grew up in Williamsville, Buffalo suburbs, and was born and raised there in Amherst and then Williamsville. Went through Williamsville South High School, then off to college in Ohio, and ultimately back here to Buffalo after a couple of years in Washington, D.C. I started playing music. Well, I started in fourth grade. I played the trombone, but that didn't last very long. I tried guitar again when I was 12 in church, and that did not last very long. And then I tried it again at age 15, and that's when it stuck. So I've been playing guitar since I was 15 and have picked up a few other instruments since then, other stringed instruments, mandolin and banjo.
Fantastic. Is there a story that from your life that, you know, when you realize sort of I am going to be a musician or I want to spend the rest of my life making music?
Yeah, there is probably several, but the one that sticks out is I have a bachelor's degree in business and psychology. I ended up with a double major in undergrad school, and not knowing what to do with that, I ended up going into the marketing field. My dad was a banker, and I was always encouraged to do something sort of along the white collar lines in terms of my livelihood. So out of college, I didn't really have a lot of passion for it, but I ended up going into marketing and advertising, and I spent 6 years in different corporate jobs. And so at age 27, I was kind of just having this crisis where I knew it wasn't for me. And I was looking around the workplace and seemingly everybody else there was perfectly happy doing what they were doing. And I just always felt like I didn't fit in. I had never really considered music as something I could make a living at. And so I always kept it to that point as a hobby. But I quit my job and I really didn't know what I was going to do next. I just had this feeling that I wasn't going to figure it out until I had left the corporate world. So I left fall of 1992 and I took a trip to India to visit a college friend of mine who is from India. Spent 3 weeks there. He encouraged me to bring my guitar. Said, oh, you know, it's going to be a hassle traveling overseas with a guitar. He said, just bring it. So I brought my guitar. Long story short, he's somebody I used to play and sing with in college. So we played and sang 6 to 8 hours every day while I was there. And by the end of that trip, it was a 3-week trip to India. By the end of that trip, I knew exactly what I was going to do with the rest of my life. It just dawned on me that, you know, this is the only thing that really ever gave me a full amount of joy. It's the only thing I've ever really cared deeply about other than my family and my friends. And so it just sort of hit me over the head while I was there that this is what I need to be doing. So at that point, I moved back to Buffalo. I'd been living in DC for a couple of years. I just decided I was going to do everything I could to try to make a living with music. So that the way that looked in 1992 was giving about 30 guitar lessons a week out of my house and playing in 3, 4, 5 different bands at night. And it's just sort of evolved from there. But that was the start of me doing music full time. And that was a really pivotal moment, I guess, when I was in India and just kind of hit me over the head. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life, you know?
Western New York Soundstage is a podcast where we really try to talk about kind of the intersection between, you know, the arts and, you know, business or the business of the arts. And I'd love for you just to sort of tell our listeners, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about the sort of those early years of, I guess, like playing multiple gigs with multiple different bands and sort of what it's like to have to put together an income from, and we don't necessarily need to know numbers, but just what the experience is like of being a young artist and kind of working in that sense.
For sure. I mean, I think one thing that's really helped me is I seem to be more or less equally left-brained and right-brained, which I know is a rare trait for most creative people. And so I've never minded the sort of hustle and the marketing and the even the administrative. I mean, the administrative side gets a little tedious, but I'm perfectly willing to do all those things that I think for so many talented artists, it's a real struggle to put the administrative stuff together, to put the marketing side of things together. So in those early years, it was, like I said, about 30 students a week. And that was, you know, back in 1992, there's no internet, obviously. So it was hanging up flyers, you know, guitar and mandolin lessons. And with the little pull tabs, you know, you could pull off my phone number. And that, you know, that went from 3-4 students a week up to, at its peak, probably 30 to 35 students a week that were coming to my house. So that was kind of decent daytime income. And then at night, it was a lot of playing around. Back then, I was playing in places like Broadway Joe's and Nietzsche's, where your show might start at 11 or 11:30 at night and play till 3 in the morning. Those really varied in terms of the income potential. But between all those activities, and then I kind of right away started to pursue things like playing music for weddings, which paid a little better than playing out in the bars. And I think it's just my fear of failure. You know, I've always had a fear of failure. I also really wanted to prove to my parents more than anything that I could make this work. You know, they were of that generation where, understandably, you know, they wanted their children to have secure, predictable incomes. And this was certainly not that. You know, I think I really wanted to prove to them and to myself that I could make it work. So I did. I just kept hustling and trying to follow, you know, where can I go and make music that I still enjoy, but that is going to provide me with a sustainable income.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I really hear you on that. I teach at a college. I teach theater, acting, and directing. I still direct. I still work. And so I hear you very much, too, especially about, you know, parents of a certain generation who are saying, like, get a job with a pension or something, you know, right. That still exists, you know, in that sense of just having, sort of finding that hustle and how thrilling it is, but also how time consuming and how difficult it is. And the only person you really can answer to is you.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think that fear of failure really has kept me employed. I just, you know, the last thing I wanted to do is have this fail and then have to go back to doing something I really didn't care about.
I think it's amazing that you are really based in Western New York. Did you ever go on a national tour or an international tour?
No, that was kind of the next thing I was going to say, is that when I was, you know, just getting established as a full-time musician in my late 20s, that was the time when a lot of my friends were really interested in going on the road and taking a band from here and going on tour and trying to get a foothold in other towns. And we have friends who did that very successfully out of Buffalo, a band called Mo, who really got their start in Buffalo around the same time that all of us were playing around in the same clubs. And, you know, they moved to Albany at some point and made that their home base. And now they're internationally known band. A lot of my friends were interested in doing that. I was not. I was kind of like, I need to stay here and figure out a way to do this sustainably and have some sort of semblance of structure in my life. You know, it's funny because now 30 years later, I'm in my late 50s and I'm now in a touring band and we're going and getting in the van at all kinds of crazy hours and going and playing late nights in towns where no one's heard of us. And I'm kind of doing this thing 30 years later than a lot of my friends did it.
I think that that's amazing. One of the reasons I was so excited to speak with you is that I have friends too, as actors or things like that, that go on tours and they're working all the time, and then they sort of drop off, and then it's like, I'm nannying again for 2 years or something. What I think is so amazing about the research that I've done about you and your resume is that almost every aspect of your life is related to your art form. And so few people can say that, right? Like, I think that that's just such an incredible thing about you.
I never quite thought about it in that way, but I suppose you're right. And I mean, and none of it really happened in any sort of way that I could have planned ahead of time. It's like one thing led to another. And I never would have had any of those opportunities had I not severed my ties with the corporate world and just launched out on my own. But luckily, I was in a place at that time where I was single, no children, no mortgage, you know, so I was really in a good position to give it a try. Like from that moment that I, in 1992, when I moved back to Buffalo and started doing music full time, it's sort of been like stumbling into one thing after the next, and I never could have planned it the way that it's ended up.
Is there a story from those sort of early years of kind of just sort of playing in the bars, or, you know, from that maybe local Buffalo listeners would be really interested in, about like an incredibly fulfilling, an incredibly fulfilling moment, or an unexpected thing that happened during that time?
You know, they tend to blend together. One thing that I'll never forget, I mean, I won't forget any of it, but one thing that I always enjoy thinking about is this weekly gig that a bunch of us had. There was a band called Acoustic Forum that used to play every Thursday at Broadway Joe's on Main Street, which is no longer there. Very fittingly, I drove by the other day and it's now a head shop. But Broadway Joe's was right next to Mickey Rad's at the corner of Main and like Minnesota, LaSalle, around that area. So we played every Thursday night for 9 years, a show. It was kind of a band that was made up of members of different bands. And we were kind of like a 6 to 8 piece bluegrass band, but with drums and electric bass. So we were kind of doing a thing that a lot of other bands just had started doing at that time. There are very, very famous bands now, like Leftover Salmon, who really had the same model that we did. And we didn't really know, we all enjoyed it a lot, but I mean, there'd be 200, 250 people there every Thursday, a lot of college students. Again, we'd start playing 11:30, 11:45 maybe was the start of the first set, and we'd play till 3. And what a great thing to be a part of. And we all learned so much about playing music. We learned at least a little bit about entertaining a crowd, but the crowd was pretty much, they were easily entertained, I would say. Didn't take a lot of showmanship. It was a really great, very powerful band with a lot of great players in it. And that's just an experience I'll never forget. And I still run into people who had been to a lot of those shows and remember that very fondly, but I certainly do.
As an independent artist, you're basically kind of like the CEO of your own business. And I think that you mentioned this earlier, and your facility with that being kind of equally left brain and right brain, or having kind of the background in marketing and business while also having like incredible love and respect and craft of artistry. So what is it like? Can you describe the life of being an independent artist where you are basically the CEO of your own business?
Sure. I mean, within about 3 years, so get into the mid 90s, I had suffered a pretty debilitating case of tennis elbow / tendonitis in my right arm, my picking arm, if you will, on the guitar. And that changed everything for me in the sense that I just physically couldn't be doing 4-hour gigs, banging it out in bars and trying to play hard enough and loud enough to be heard over drums and everything else. So I really, at that point, I shifted. I had started doing some work in school settings. Again, just something I stumbled into. There's a trio in Buffalo called the Hill Brothers, and they, since the 70s, had been going into schools. It was Jerry Raven and Judd Sunshine, and they had just lost their third member. They go into schools and do essentially what are, you might remember as assembly programs, where like the whole school comes down to the auditorium, you know, 2-3 times a year, and there's a performer, and they do something that's sort of half educational and half entertaining. So that's what they had been doing since the 70s. And I joined them in the early 90s because their third member had left town. So that was something I was doing a little bit of. Once we get to 1995 and the tendonitis thing happened and really flared up, fortunately, I had that school performing end of things that was not super demanding in terms of physical toll on my arm. The shows are 40 minutes long instead of 4 hours, and it's really not, it doesn't have the same kind of demands physically. From that moment on, I made it my goal to do as much of that as I could to make that a bigger and bigger percentage of my livelihood, doing these kind of educational performances in schools. So in terms of being a CEO, I mean, that's kind of really where I think of that part of my career starting, is once I made this daytime educational performing kind of the meat and potatoes of what I do for my income, that's when I really, you know, saw myself even using some of the things I learned in business school, and at least some of the frameworks I had to use when I had my career in marketing, just to keep it all afloat. I mean, you can't go out and perform 5 days a week if you also are the person that's doing all the administrative stuff, the invoices, the confirmations, the back and forth correspondence with every single, I mean, you have hundreds of bosses every year. You have hundreds of workplaces every year when you're a freelance independent artist. And so for me, for my sanity, I need about 2 days a week out of a 5-day work week of administrative time where I can do more outreach for more and better gigs. where I can take care of all the administrative stuff, and then say 3 days on average where I'm out actually performing that work. That's one approach that's worked for me. A lot of people in my position would prefer to just let someone else do the booking, and I understand that completely because it's not for everybody. And in that case, you can go out and work 5 days a week, and then you pay somebody else to do some of those other tasks that you don't want to do. For me, I kind of enjoy both sides of it enough that I don't mind doing both. I can't do the performing end, you know, 5, 6, 7 days a week.
On your website, you call yourself a teaching artist, and I think that that is amazing. I'm also a teaching artist for a while. Oh, cool. I worked for about 3 years as a teaching artist, and maybe you've been here at Bethel Woods, which was the Woodstock concert site.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's where you are right now?
No. I'm based in Western New York. I teach at Fredonia State University.
Okay.
But before I was here, I was in Sullivan County and working at Bethel Woods. So yeah. Just kind of the interplay between music and art was such an incredible thing there. And I learned that even as a teacher now, I think of myself in some ways as a teaching artist. Can you tell us we're going on and on about this and listeners may not know, but what is a teaching artist?
In my world, what that means is that I'm an artist that goes into educational settings and uses my art to convey information. For me, my passion has always been history through music. So, you know, take an elementary school. Third graders in every elementary school in New York State learn about cultures around the world. Fourth graders in every elementary school in New York State learn about New York State history. So there's music that goes along with all of those things. And so the role of the teaching artist is to bring your art form in and help the kids connect with what it is that they're already tasked with learning. So third graders are learning about cultures around the world. Let's bring in some world instruments and some songs from all over the world and get them singing in different languages. You know, fourth graders are learning about the Erie Canal. So let's bring in a whole show of music that is deeply rooted in our history here surrounding the canal, and use that music to get the kids excited about what it is that they're learning. So it's that's sort of my definition. And there are lots of different definitions of what a teaching artist is. But for me, it's using your art form to convey information.
I completely agree. And I think it's such a necessary and incredible thing to bring to young people. I'm sure that some of the young people that you play for in schools have maybe never even seen a mandolin.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah. Even the guitar, occasionally people haven't seen. Banjo is always a really, a really funny one. All of a sudden, about 10 years ago, everybody knew what a banjo was. I'm not sure what changed. There must've been something in popular culture. It used to be you pull out the banjo and everybody would kind of look at it like, what's that? Then all of a sudden, one year, you know, pull out the banjo and everybody gets all super excited. And now that happens every time I pull out the banjo. So somehow, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're one of the things I've learned along this line of work is that the days of coming in, let's say you're a folk musician, for instance, the days of coming in and teaching kids about folk music and here's the instruments we play and here's what folk music is, those are kind of over, unfortunately. The schools just simply don't have time in their day with all the standardized testing and everything else that they have to worry about. And it's unfortunate, but they just don't have the time to dedicate to something that has pure cultural value. It really does need to connect with what it is that they're already learning. So if you can take your art form and figure out a way to connect it to school curriculum, whether that's science or math or English language arts or social studies, in my case, history, that's really where the sweet spot is.
Yeah, I have a friend who says marketing is either creating a need or filling a need, right? And so bringing your skills to that is exactly what you're doing.
Right.
There's a George Bernard Shaw, who was a famous sort of playwright and theorist. Yeah. You know, the Shaw Festival locally is named after him in Canada, who had this sort of like blistering quote, which I'll say, and then I'll kind of say an addendum to it. But I've been said this, or it's been said to me as a teaching artist, and you, the George Bernard Shaw quote of those who can't teach. I vehemently disagree with that. And I have a friend who sort of amended it by said, those who can do more teach. So I'm interested to know how teaching informs your artistry.
I tend to think of it as the other way around. I think my artistry informs my teaching. And again, I'm not a trained educator. I am someone who augments, I would say, you know, comes in and augments the learning rather than, you know, I'm not the one tasked with teaching curriculum, but I'm certainly complementing it and augmenting it. I mean, teaching to me is an art form in itself in terms of how to convey information effectively, how to convey it in a way that's going to stick. And a lot of that has to do with getting the learner involved in the learning, right? Most kids today, most adults today are not passive receptacles that can sit for a long period of time and just take in information. They need to be actively involved in their own learning, you know? So that's kind of how I think of that.
That's great. I also kind of looking at your website, it seems like you really understand the importance of diversification in every way. Like your online store not only sells CDs, but trainings for musicians and artists. How did this come about?
So those came about because another physical ailment of sorts in around 2015, I started to have some real issues with my voice, my singing and speaking voice, just from overuse and from not ever having been properly trained in sort of the mechanics of breathing and for public speaking and singing. And so I was doing so many shows a year at that point that I started to get hoarse. My singing voice started to crack a lot. And I realized that I needed to kind of take a step back and learn some new tools. I took that opportunity to start a blog for musicians. And the reason I did it is just because, you know, I have so many talented friends, even locally, who, you know, musically are almost untouchable. They're so good, but yet they struggle to make a sustainable living doing it. And people over the years, the more I got into this line of sort of educational performing and working in schools, would ask me about it. Like, well, how does that work? And how do you do that? And how much can you charge? And, you know, what is your typical day look like? Things like that. So I just decided this is my opportunity. I'd always wanted to do some sort of like teaching on that, because I love helping people. So I started a blog and I published an article every week for about 75 weeks, I think, just sort of dumping out everything I've learned about marketing yourself as a performer, about doing this educational work, about getting gigs in sort of out of the way places that tend to pay a lot better than the standard. You know, one of the classic lines you'll hear a lot of local musicians say is, well, there's no good paying gigs out there. You know, nobody pays well anymore, you know, and it's simply not true. It's just most people don't kind of know where to look. And so through the course of writing this blog every week, publishing those articles, and then Google after a while discovered the content and decided to feature it when someone's searching for whatever, you know, how to make money as a musician, my articles tend to come up pretty high in the search results. So that blog now gets tens of thousands of visitors a month, which is wild because I haven't written anything new there in quite a few years. But all the info there is still relevant. So that's where that sort of teaching or training for artists came in. And as a function of that, I started to offer these webinars for subscribers. So I had a couple thousand subscribers to the blog. I started offering, you know, like let's do a 2-hour intensive on how to book yourself in schools, how to get school gigs, how to put together a more effective website, how to write really compelling emails that get people to take action, things like that. And so those became sort of paid trainings I would offer to my subscribers. And then I recorded those and they're now offered for sale on my website as a training.
That's amazing. And I think too, for listeners that are listening to this that may not necessarily be musicians, but might be in the arts, there's so much great information on your blog that could be easily applicable to any art form.
I think so too. Even any small business, really. I've had people say, yeah, like I'm the guitar player, but my wife reads this for her home cleaning business, you know, because a lot of it is just marketing best practices and those apply across the board, you know.
Fantastic. You are on YouTube and you have a number of performances on YouTube and people can check out really your virtuosic performances on YouTube. Your online presence just across the board is so strong. What is your relationship with kind of YouTube or recording yourself or things like that?
Well, I started doing virtual performances for schools in the year 2014. There was a platform at the time called Concert Window that a lot of musicians were using to start to do virtual performances. This is long before everybody discovered Zoom in 2020 with COVID. I got real curious as to whether I could apply this to the schoolwork that I do so that I could be here home in Buffalo, New York in my studio and broadcasting essentially my school programs to far-flung places. So I started to experiment with that in 2014. And just as a result of that, I think I got a lot more comfortable on the camera and I just learned some basic things about lighting and kind of presenting to an audience that you can't see. That's one of the big differences is when I do, and I still do offer these kinds of things for schools, where I'll have six schools in six different parts of the country all tuned into the same event, and they can see and hear me. I cannot see and hear them because you can't have 100 classrooms up on your screen. And so there's this whole way of I've developed of sort of like interacting with an audience that I can't see, but it involves just a leap of faith that they're actually doing the things you're asking them to do, like sing this back to me, or, you know, when I sing this, we're going to move our bodies this way. So the feedback from teachers is always like the receiving end. They all think you can actually see them and hear them because I've done all these performances enough times where I kind of know what's going to make them laugh and where they're going to mess up and things like that. So I've become, I guess, very comfortable with video and both live stream and recorded video through this sort of exploration of trying to beam my things into schools. So really over the last 8 years. And then, so then there's all kinds of content I can upload to YouTube from there.
How are these educational performances and the family performances that you do maybe different than more traditional concerts? And there's no necessarily judgment on that. I'm just wondering like how they are different.
Well, for one, it's not about you at all. It's about the audience and it's about what the material is that you're presenting. So in other words, it's not like I'm going to wow you with my musical skills or my singing voice or anything like that. It's you're there for a purpose. You're being hired to deliver an end result, which is an engaged audience. And that can be a kind of a leap for some people to make in their mind. A lot of times, the way these educational bookings work is they don't even want to hear you. They don't even want to hear what you sound like ahead of time. They've just heard good things about you from another educational school or wherever that's already hired you and been very pleased with what you did. Or maybe they just, I do a ton of outreach, ton of marketing. So they get your email and the program that you're offering, the theme that you're offering is what they're interested in. They kind of almost don't care if there's three people delivering it or one or what you sound like. You know, you never get asked to maybe occasionally you get asked if you have a video they can look at before they decide whether they want to hire you. But most of the time it's not. It's just they can tell that you know the content and that's what they're really interested in.
Some of your offerings online or what you offer to schools and what you sort of mentioned earlier has to connect with curriculum. Yeah. And it seems like some of that is that you have connected with traditional American music.
Yeah, very much so. Go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say, why is it important to keep these traditional music forms alive?
You know, traditional American music is not something I spent any time thinking about until I joined the Hill Brothers. I mentioned that the school performing group that I stumbled into around 1995, and they were doing two different themed shows that had to do with American folk music. One was a show on music from New York State's history. The other was a show on sort of Appalachian culture and sort of homemade music and kind of picking up found items, whether it's a wash tub or a washboard or a pair of spoons and getting some music out of them. And so the experience of learning those two shows, because these are, especially the way the Hill Brothers did it, these are scripted shows. Like there's three members on stage, but we're saying the exact same lines at the exact same time every show. And there's some shtick involved and there's a lot of audience participation involved. As a result of learning those two shows, it got me more curious. Like I never really thought about, you know, does New York State have its own sort of traditional music? You know, I've always thought of that as something that only existed down south in the Appalachian Mountains, you know. Turns out every locality around the globe has their own music. This stuff from the pre-radio days, stuff people used to entertain themselves with before they had radios and TVs that they could turn on and be entertained in the home. You were on your own. You had to make your own entertainment. And not everyone was musical, but certainly people in general had a little more ability to at least carry around a few songs in their head that they could sing just to relieve the tedium or to pass the time as they were working or what have you. So I never spent much time thinking about that stuff until I joined the Hill Brothers. And it's kind of been an obsession ever since. So, and I really, I've become very fond of the traditional music from all different kinds of places around the world. But my one area of real focus became the music from our own backyard, basically New York State's folk music, if you will. Before it was called folk music, it was just, you know, the music people entertained themselves with back when people did that.
How does listening or hearing this music affect the way we hear contemporary music?
Well, it can be night and day. Fortunately, we do have some old field recordings that were made by some of the early song collectors. People might be familiar with a name like Alan Lomax, who was probably the best known American song collector, people who went around just as radios were coming into people's homes and knocked on doors and asked people if they remembered any songs they'd learned in their family from their from the elders, and started to preserve those, record those. And so fortunately, we have some field recordings that were made here in New York State of people who were in their 70s in the year 1939, you know, so people who were born in the middle of the 19th century or toward the end of the 19th century, singing the songs that they used to hear around their community and entertaining themselves with. And so that style of singing, it's not about, if we're going to compare it to modern music or to popular music today, that style of singing is all about telling a story. It's about conveying a story. It's not about, many of these people were not what you would call classically good singers. They simply sang the song again to tell the story or to just pass the time. And so it's not really about the performance of the song. It's about the telling of the music, the telling of the story. And then on the instrumental side, you have primarily fiddle music was really big in 19th century New York State. I don't know if I could draw an easy comparison to popular music of today. It's tended to be stuff that you learned from someone else as opposed to out of a book. Certainly people had sheet music books that they would learn pieces out of as well. But a lot of that is all oral tradition where you learned it from your father or from your uncle or from the guy on the work site who knew a couple's tunes. And so you learned them from them. And so there's this one neat comparison you can make or one contrast there is that these old songs, they tend to change with every single person who picks it up, and either through the process of conscious, you know, I didn't like this set of words, so I added my own, or the whole unconscious telephone game kind of concept where you hear me play it and then you go home and you try to remember what I played and you're playing it and it might come out a little different. And then someone hears you play it and, you know, it goes on and on and on like that. So there are endless variations as opposed to, let's say, a Beatles song where there's only one way a Beatles song goes. You know, it goes that way every single time. And if you're going to sing it or play it, you better sing the right words and play the right chords. You know, that's one big difference between the two, I would say.
So I think it's incredible that you have had a career as a full-time person working in the arts since, you said, I think 1994.
92,
1992. I have 2 degrees in fine arts, so I cannot do that math, so I won't insult you with it. But I'm just wondering if you had any advice for a young person listening who was looking towards or wanted a career in the arts, what might you say to them?
I would say there's so many different ways to do it. I think today, and even probably 30 years ago when I started, there's this notion that, you know, if I'm going to be successful with music, I'm going to need to end up on TV. I'm going to need to become a household name. I'm going to need to have a recording contract with one of the major companies. That certainly was part of what kept me from doing it, probably much sooner than I would have. And I think it's what keeps a lot of other people from it, is we have this sort of one image of what that would look like. And the reality is, I mean, I'm somebody who no one's ever heard of outside of these kind of niche areas that I perform in, but yet I make a very comfortable living doing this kind of work. And so there's just so many ways to skin it. And I guess the other biggest takeaway, I think I've already said it probably, but I never could have designed the way it's turned out for me. It's sort of like by putting myself in the position where I had to figure it out is how things continued to evolve, and they're still evolving.
Well, Dave, we are heading into the sort of final moments of our interview. Before we go, I'd love to ask, is there anything that you feel is left unsaid or anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Sure. I mean, kind of an interesting development. About 4.5 years ago, we had a 50th birthday party for my wife, and I had hired a band that she really likes. And at the last minute, the electric guitar player could not make the gig. He had a medical issue. And so the band leader called me up. He said, well, we either have to cancel or we're going to need to find another guitar player. And I said, well, why don't I do it? You know, and so I hadn't played electric guitar in 25 years at that point. I'd been strictly pursuing sort of like acoustic music, but I had an old Stratocaster in the closet and an old Fender amp. And so to save the gig, I said, I'll do it. You know, I'll learn the music and we'll get together and rehearse. So never did I have so much fun in my life as I did getting out my electric guitar again. It was just something I didn't even realize I had missed. And so from that point till today, there's been this whole new whole side of my career, which involves playing electric guitar. I started an original group of two dear friends right before the pandemic. The group is called Organ Fairchild. It's an organ trio. So it's organ, guitar, electric guitar, and drums. And we started writing our own music. I had never written a note of my own music until I was in my mid-50s. And so we've all been writing music, and now we're out touring and getting in the van and driving to unknown locales and playing for people who've never seen us before. And also, we've been very well supported around Buffalo. We do a number of really fun shows every year in Buffalo. So I'm too old to have it be a midlife crisis, but it's been a great rediscovery that I love to rock on the electric guitar. And so that's been a whole new fun chapter, and that's continuing.
That's amazing. Amazing. And how fun that must have, or what a nice sort of surprise that must have been for your wife to kind of have you sort of playing.
It was, yeah. Now I think she's maybe questioning it because I'm gone most weekends. And but no, it's all good.
Great. Dave, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find more information about you, your tour schedule, everything like that?
Sure. So for the band, it's organfairchild.com. And then for my own work in schools and educational stuff and traditional music, it's just my name. So Dave Ruck, DaveRuch.com.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was great. Thanks, Daniel. It's great talking to you.
Thank you. Well, that's our show for today. It was fantastic to speak to Dave about his life and career in the arts. I want to reiterate the sentiment that I shared earlier in the episode, which is those who can do more teach. Dave is an invaluable member of the Western New York arts community, and I hope you will check out his website and see him live. Today's show is produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmaker engineered the episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local events guides posted monthly on buffalorising.com. We'll be back soon with more episodes where we will explore our local creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising, Local Matters Studios.